Thank you for listening to the Highlander Podcast, where we have conversations about the past, present, and future of the outdoor industry. Thanks to Utah State University's Outdoor Product Design and Development Program for making it possible and for training the future product leaders of the outdoor industry. Learn more about the program at opdd.usu.edu. The Highlander Podcast is sponsored by the Outdoor Recreation Archive, a collaboration between OPDD and USU Special Collections to preserve the history and print materials of the people, products, and brands of the outdoor industry. Follow the archive at Outdoor Rec Archive on Instagram. The Highlander Podcast is sponsored by the Utah Outdoor Association, a business association focused on elevating Utah's outdoor industry through educational programming and events. Their membership consists of Utah's outdoor manufacturers, retailers, outfitters, and guides. Member benefits include networking opportunities, recruitment of talent, and brand promotion. More information about volunteering and membership is available at utahoutdoor.org. On this episode of The History of Gear, Dr. Rachel Gross, Assistant Professor of History at the University of Colorado, Denver, and one of our 2022 Outdoor Recreation Archive Fellows, returns to the podcast to talk about her new book, Shopping All the Way to the Woods, How the Outdoor Industry Sold Nature to America. Welcome back, everyone, to our History of Gear series. I'm excited to have one of our recurring guests. I've lost track of how many times you've been on. Maybe this is four or five, but I think you hold the record for most appearances on the podcast. But of course, Dr. Rachel Gross, Assistant Professor of History at the University of Colorado, Denver. Thanks for being here.
Happy to be back. Thanks, Chase.
Yeah, it's always great to have you back. And I always get such good feedback whenever we drop an episode with you, or when you've talked to our history summit. I think there's just a hunger for the what you're producing, the work that you do, because it's so unique. And that's what I want to talk a little bit about today, is something truly unique. This new book that you've written, Shopping All the Way to the Woods, How the Outdoor Industry Sold Nature to America. There's truly nothing like it in the industry. And I think people who have followed your work, and you're probably already hearing this, have been clamoring for this for a long time. I don't know, is that the sense you've gotten? Has there been a demand for this kind of a publication?
You know, I have had enthusiastic audiences say they're looking forward to this story. And I think one of the best ways that I notice that is not, I can't wait to read what you're writing, but how much, when I share my research, people are prompted to think of their own story. So for me, kind of the best sign of audiences who are engaged are, oh yeah, I remember these other things that I participated in. I see myself in that story. That's where it feels like a really rewarding match between what readers are hoping for and then kind of what I'm able to offer.
Well, I think that's cool, because like at the beginning of the book, and I haven't really heard your side of this story, right? Like I've heard aspects of your personal connection to the outdoor industry, but I love how at the beginning of the book, like you really ground this in your experience, like connecting with the outdoors and running into this issue of like, who belongs in outdoor spaces and what do you need? Like what's the gear that you need to be qualified to participate in the outdoors? Like I thought it was really interesting how you grounded everything in like your experience. And I imagine a lot of people will be able to relate to that.
I mean, I don't know. I hope I get to talk to audiences far more expert than me in a lot of the activities that I'm still just an amateur in. But yeah, certainly what you're referencing is kind of as a young adult, when I was so eager to be an outdoorsy person and I wanted to just buy all the stuff to make sure I looked the part. I imagine that many people have gone through versions of that, if not for the outdoors and in other areas of their life where they want to belong and they want to make sure that they have the look, the goods that identify them as a part of that insider group. It's a process that so many of us as consumers and kind of people who, you know, crave that part of our identity want to express.
I think this book will be an interesting mirror for people who work in the outdoor industry, for people who participate in these activities, because I think there is a uniform and it's just something that's taken for granted, right? Like I think for a lot of people who work in the industry, it's just assumed like what that person looks like or what you need to participate in the industry. And I think this book does a phenomenal job of kind of holding up a mirror to the industry and you know, causing us to reflect on like, what does it mean to be outdoorsy, right? What are the qualities of an outdoorsy person? Or, and you dig into that more in depth, but I think that was really, really interesting. When did you, and you mentioned this in the book, when did you realize that you were the first outdoor gear historian? Like, people have written about the outdoors, but not in the way that you come about doing it. And from your perspective, like, when did you realize that this was kind of a unique opportunity for you and an emphasis area?
So there's an academic version of, you know, the answer to that question, which is in graduate school, we read the literatures of our field. And I've looked at, you know, lots of really excellent books that study the history of national parks or public lands more broadly, and other recreational activities. And so I know and really respect all of that work. And I realized, okay, and there's a space in the academic sense where people aren't writing about the consumer products or the companies that sold them. That's one answer to the question. But the other one, it has to do with archives. And, you know, this is, you know, your university specialty in many ways. I knew I was the first because there was no place to go to find all of this material and nobody knew where it was either. So as I traveled around the country over the last decade and a half, assembling kind of piecemeal the research that I needed to tell the stories that eventually appeared in this book, people were recognizing like, oh, no one has come in search of this material before. No one's ever asked to see our archives. And that's partly how I knew that, at least from the industry side, there wasn't somebody before me who had gone around and collected it. And so I'm delighted to be a part of that first round of people who've recognized the value of telling an industry history and then trying to capture it while it still exists and is able to be preserved.
So for those who aren't in the academic world like you and me, what is the value of looking at the outdoor industry from that more academic or historical perspective?
There are so many really excellent personal reflections on the outdoor industry and its history. But what none of those can do is give an overall perspective on kind of broader trends in the country's history and how the specialized industry interacts with those. So for instance, many people kind of know kind of the layperson's version of the story that army surplus after World War II became a really big part of what consumers sought to buy. And then a lot of those stores somehow turned into the outdoor stores of the 1970s. People know that story because they lived it. However, an academic treatment of it says, well, where did the goods come from? How did people acquire them? How much did they cost? And what was the marketing of those products back in the 1950s that led to the stores that we now know today? I don't think any individual can do that because they're very much focused on kind of their personal histories or the things that they helped to build, which are often remarkable, but it means that they're not necessarily asking questions about, oh, what are the broader structures when it comes to reconversion from a military to civilian economy that kind of the government officials were thinking about. And that's what a historian can offer is both these individual accounts, but put them alongside really big trends in our country's past.
Right. How is it that no one has done this before? Like I look at other industries like, and you and I have talked a lot about the Hagley Museum and Library, and that how, and you correct me if I'm wrong, it's a museum and library that documents the history of like American industry. Correct. And primarily like companies like, is it DuPont and, you know, more of the big chemical companies, you know. And that's kind of the void that we're trying to fill, right? It's like, we need a Hagley Museum for the outdoor industry. Like, it, you know, in the last few years, there's been, you know, reports from the Bureau of Economic Analysis talking about the impact of the industry, you know, the more economic side of the industry and the impact and how significant it is to the U.S. economy. Like, how is it that, you know, no one's really looked at this before? I guess, where do you think that comes from?
Yeah. I think it's because for both people within the industry and then the fans, the consumers, the people who love, you know, with a deep passion this world, it has often been interpreted as not exactly frivolous, but at least because it's focused on leisure, not serious enough, right? It's not significant enough to be able to tell something about our national story. It's not crucial enough to help us understand politics. And I think that's a misinformed opinion, right? I think that in many ways, looking at really fun, school objects is a way into telling these much more serious and kind of broad scope stories. And in other industries, people have recognized that sooner. So for instance, the Science History Institute based in Philadelphia, which is focused on kind of the chemical industry, broadly speaking, came about in part because people within the industry recognized, oh, we've had really big impacts on this kind of on history. Let's capture them. Let's tell our own story. And now there's a an academic center that funds kind of researchers, that has a library and an archive that's based on that kind of initial idea. The Hagley is quite similar. And so I do agree that in many ways, kind of what the industry needs is a group of people who also want to take this history seriously and recognize that what they've contributed, what they've helped to build, is crucial to telling part of the American story. And it's not just for fun, right? It's not just about recreation. It is those things, but it's more than that too.
Well, I can't imagine anyone, after reading this book can walk away feeling like the outdoor industry is not part of the American story. Like, I think you do a phenomenal job of like helping us understand that the outdoors is baked into who we are as a country and as a people. So I think that's fascinating. And you knocked it out of the park with, if that was one of your goals or something that you identified as an opportunity. So with that said, I wanted to read some of the chapter titles, if I can, just to give people a flavor for what to expect. Buckskin, the origins of outdoor style, which probably fun for you because I know that was the buckskin was a key part of your thesis, right?
Yeah, exactly.
A green respite, creating the outdoor store. Buckskin, trademarking the American past. Feather foam and pocket stoves, the making of a scientific industry. Pup tents and mummy bags, spreading surplus to the masses. Lederhosen and Tyrolean hats, mm-hmm. Forging community with brands. Rucksack revolution, the supermarket of the outdoors. And bean boots and puffy jackets, lifestyle and America's outdoor heritage. Like every one of those, I imagine there's even more you wanted to dive into and more you could explore with each of those chapters. Did you have a hard time like really scaling this down into a book that could be digestible for people? I feel like each of these chapters could be its own book and its own like era within the outdoor industry.
Yeah, I mean, I think we would agree on that because we share the kind of an enthusiasm for these types of stories. Part of what I was looking for was like particular products that would be good examples of the era, because I knew I couldn't cover every fascinating invention from a particular time period. There's too many, and there are too many really good stories and individuals, and I can't capture them all. And so in some ways, when I narrow down on, say, down sleeping bags or tents in the 1940s and 50s, what I'm doing is saying, is this a good example of the broader trends, and can I hang my story on it? So yeah, I definitely had trouble narrowing down because there are so many fun products, especially the further we get to the modern period, the more individuals came up to me and said, "Hey, you got to tell this story of this thing," and I agreed with them. I wish I could do all of those stories, and so I imagine in kind of future iterations of this research, or perhaps kind of with other folks down the line with new materials now at the outdoor recreation industry archive, there'll be the potential for a lot more stories to fill in the blanks because there's so much more.
Well, I guess back to your point, right? Like, you don't know what you don't know. And in this space that is evolving, as we find materials and we talk to people who were there and who started these companies, who worked for these companies, not all of it is documented. Like just yesterday, I talked to an individual, Nancy Grimes, who started Banana Equipment in the 70s. And they were one of the first companies to use Gore-Tex in clothing, right up there with Early Winters, right? But the average outdoor industry enthusiast would never know anything about them, right? So it's I imagine as a historian, it's a constant challenge, right? Like you're trying to find this narrative, or document this narrative about the outdoor industry, but there's always missing pieces. There's always companies that you don't know about. Is that difficult for you as a historian to, at some point you kind of have to surrender to the fact that you don't have all the pieces.
Right.
What is that a challenge? Does that cause, some anxiety for you?
It definitely does, in part because I know that this history is so personal to many people, and I want to capture kind of not just every product, because that's impossible, but more kind of the feeling of a certain era so that it resonates with the people who lived it. And so I do think about like, oh, did I miss something because I didn't have access to a particular company or particular kind of stories materials? And the answer is probably yes. And at the same time, I do think kind of the story is shaped in part by what people have chosen to save, what archives, have made things available. And so in that sense, I don't feel like a guilt over it as a historian as much as kind of reflective about the historian's process. Publicly accessible materials mean there are stories to be told, and I hope that in some ways, kind of the missing pieces or the places I know that there's more to say, that will be a prompt for other companies or individuals who have these really rich resources to think like, oh, we could open these up and make them available to more people.
We've kind of danced around this a little bit, the central thesis of the book, but we probably ought to talk about that. My perspective, and then of course I want to hear your take on it, is it's this idea of who can access the outdoors and what qualifies someone to participate in outdoor activities through the gear. You know, what is the right gear? Who determines what right means for the trail or for outdoor spaces? How would you sum up kind of the central thesis of the book?
Yeah, I mean, I think Chase, you've really captured it. The book is about the American outdoor identity and how so many consumers, as well as the people who sold the gear, thought you can access the authentic version of what it means to be an outdoors person by buying stuff, right? By acquiring the goods, the clothing and gear of the outdoors. Consumers define themselves, companies defined their identities, as well. And they sussed out who was in and who was out, who was an expert and who was a beginner. And not necessarily in ways that are reflective of some objective level of expertise and skill, right? It was much more about kind of like what identities go with certain kinds of products. And if you buy these socks, it shows that you know something, right? I think in some ways the book is arguing not there is a best packing list, there is the best set of clothes, and if you only know that, you're gonna have access to the secret. Instead, what it shows is the kind of debates about the American outdoor identity prove there is no single version of that, but many people have kind of battled around like what it means to belong and what products are going to be the entry point into that identity as well.
Well, I think this idea of identity is really interesting, right? And using clothes as a way of communicating who you are, what your values are, like, you know, putting on different identities, I think is really, really interesting and is maybe a larger conversation within the larger fashion industry, but maybe a new conversation, a relatively new conversation in this outdoor space, which makes it especially exciting, right? It feels so new to this you know, industry in particular. I kind of wanted to get into like some of those ideas that are uniquely, you know, make up the uniquely American outdoor identity. And you know, again, if I'm missing some, like white masculinity is kind of the first one that pops up, and this like Theodore Roosevelt. And I like how, you know, I don't remember if you said this or if this was a quote that you were pulling from, but this idea of playing at frontier hunter or playing dress up, like at the end of the day, that's what clothing allows us to do is play dress up, you know, communicate values and identity to other people. But thoughts there on this idea of like white masculinity, Theodore Roosevelt, like this going back really far. And again, at the core of like the American identity.
I don't think people will be surprised to learn that Teddy Roosevelt is one of the kind of early icons of the outdoors. But the way that I present it in this book isn't, oh, people just want to emulate him and he represents a rugged masculinity of the past, but rather that even in the 19th century, Theodore Roosevelt, like his contemporaries, were playing at being authentic outdoorsmen, right? They were in search of kind of the best costume that would show, I belong, I'm authentic, I really know what I'm doing out here. And so when Roosevelt acquires from a native woman a buckskin suit and then puts it on kind of in an East Coast studio to say, look, I've been into the West and I really know what I'm doing. He is enacting kind of that performance of expertise and belonging. And so that's why he's an icon, not because he's a true hunter of the past that we ought to be just like, but rather because he shows how much even these people who we assume are kind of the more authentic people because they come earlier, from the nostalgic era when men were men. No, he's actually working hard to try and push that image of himself. And so we can kind of break down through his use of clothing, like the buckskin suit, how he's putting on a show to emulate that idea. And so that's one of the ways that I explore white masculinity in the late 19th century is showing, oh, how people kind of talked about buckskin suits and then how they actually acquired them, which was very different from what they said on paper, reflects these ideas that kind of white men were saying the outdoors is for us and we are inheritors from a disappearing Native American past, when that really wasn't the case. And for the most part, Native American women were the true experts in this outdoor space that they were trying to co-opt.
Well, and those are, I mean, conversations even today around the outdoor industry, around cultural appropriation of designs and product. And it's interesting how much that has like continued in the outdoor industry even today. There's one point kind of in this section where you say these people like Roosevelt and others who are wearing buckskin wanted both to play Indian and to maintain their seat on the train, their service at a restaurant, and their ability to court a lady. So wanting to be able to live in both these worlds and reap the quote unquote benefits of that, that idea of putting on new identities is really interesting. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, there are so many cases in kind of early outdoor literature about mistaken identity, where it turned out, you know, that stranger on the train or in the restaurant or out on horseback out in the field appears to be an Indian, but then like he is revealed to be actually a white man who has very good manners and is elite, but he just couldn't tell because of his dirty face and the clothes that he wore. And I think these narratives of mistaken identity are really interesting because they mirror other kind of anecdotes about race relations during the time period where white men are able to navigate multiple worlds quite easily and kind of put on or take off another group's identity as a way to both prove their superiority and their kind of ability to kind of co-opt the expertise of that group or to benefit from the kind of their culture, while at the same time not giving up any of the privileges of their position. And so when you're reading about kind of maintaining their space on the train, often people would be told, like, you don't belong in this first class cabin, you need to leave. And then they would reveal themselves to be actually someone who is a holder of a ticket and who has lots of money and does in fact belong. But that kind of delight that these men showed in being able to play in both worlds show that they're quite conscious of the kind of racial superiority that they are reinforcing.
Right. So just scratching the surface on that topic, I mean, you've got multiple chapters just kind of exploring this idea. The other one, this uniquely American outdoor identity, another aspect of that that really stuck out to me is kind of military influence and the problematic link between conquest and outdoor recreation. And I feel like I've heard that a lot more as well as we talk about outdoor spaces and using the term explore. When a lot of these spaces have been inhabited for generations and you know, hundreds, if not thousands of years, like they're not being explored. So this idea of conquest in the outdoor space and how that's tied to the military was really fascinating. And something that I know you and I have talked quite a bit about with outdoor brands kind of being born out of a lot of brands being born out of World War II, companies like Jerry and Holy Bar and that military influence. But why do you feel like that's a uniquely American or a part of that identity of an American outdoors person is that military influence?
Yeah. So part of the answer is that you can see it in the style. So the U.S. military uniforms have influenced first outdoor recreation and the clothes there, but also more popular styles. And so there's been a really kind of widespread embrace of military styling, the colors, the camo, you know, the look of it when it comes to what people buy for everyday products. And I think that reflects kind of a broad endorsement of kind of the U.S. military's pervasive presence kind of in American culture. But then the other part of the answer has to do with the really direct line that U.S. military engagement has with product development and then kind of the expansion of business stateside in the years that followed. The book traces the influence of kind of military laboratories and kind of research facilities during World War II and how that shaped not just the actual products, but the ways that people in the industry ask questions about how to test goods, how to, you know, get them to a broad audience, how to teach people about the kind of very idea of layering itself. And that goes beyond just a question of style. Like, okay, I'm wearing khaki or I'm wearing the shirts that are, you know, come out of the military. That's one story. But the other one has to do with the ideas that the military pushed that have been embraced really broadly in the culture. And I think looking at the broad reach of the American government and the military during World War II is a way of seeing like, oh, this influence is pervasive to the point where we didn't even notice it. That's why that story, I think, is really valuable.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. The military influence is fascinating. And I think a lot of it is, you know, stems from, you know, being close to some of those materials, like the Jerry collection that we have here at the university and hearing those stories and, you know, and so I think that whole, the military connection is really interesting, and the people will, I don't think that's something that people, maybe you notice it from time to time in some of the styling, but you know, mm-hmm. there's some deeper ideas, mm-hmm. you know, underneath all of that, that might be pretty new for people. Mm-hmm. And then this third point that kind of stuck out to me around the American outdoor identity is shopping. Right. And again, it's the first word in the title of the book, right? Shopping is always first. This idea that in order to go out on an excursion or participate in the outdoors, like you need to shop for the right stuff first. So this mm-hmm. idea of consumerism and purchasing product as a way to access the outdoors is another one of those points. What are your thoughts there? I mean, of course, that seems like at the core of, you know, these three points, that's like one of the foundational pieces is the shopping component.
Yeah. Shopping has such an interesting relationship to outdoor recreation because so many people who want to participate in these activities and so many people who work in the industry side and who want to push the activities as well are really suspicious of commercial life, right? So there's this tension where like the notion that outdoor recreation is somehow about escape, experiencing nature, being in the wilderness, being out there is somehow in opposition to like what it means to go shopping and like everyday like mass consumerism that we're experiencing all the time. Those two things are in conflict from the very beginning of the industry and of outdoor recreation itself in the 19th century. And so, yes, shopping is one of the really crucial experiences that I trace throughout the book. And I don't just say, look, people loved shopping. I say, look how they wrestled with it. They wanted the stuff because of what it meant, but they really shunned the idea that they needed to acquire goods in order to access these activities or even that expertise. And so the question about what does it mean to kind of shop on your way to the woods is one that evolves over time. There are different store experiences. There are different companies that come into prominence and then fall away over the course of the 19th and 20th century. But what remains consistent is that participating in this commercialism is an entry point to outdoor recreation, right? That it's hard to separate the activities from the acquisition of goods. I don't think that's a good relationship necessarily. I think it's very fun. I love the gear and I'm certainly kind of a fan myself. I participate in all of these trends that I describe. But I do think that consumers and producers are right to be suspicious of the tight link between acquisition on the one hand and then outdoor experiences on the other. And we know that so many of kind of the broader concerns we have about the future of our Earth have to do with every one of our like companies and individuals kind of rampant or participation in this rampant culture of consumerism. So it's a tenuous, tricky relationship that is consistent throughout the period that I cover.
This idea has caused me to look at, you know, modern day and the current outdoor companies and the way that they market their products. And I think there's a wrestle going on within the industry, right, around this idea of like, you need to buy our stuff in order to be qualified to participate in the outdoors. But I'm more in tune with it now where I see, you know, the way that companies talk about their product and position themselves as these gatekeepers for the outdoors is really fascinating. And it's something I'm definitely more tuned into now that, you know, I've kind of, you know, read this section and learned more about, you know, the work that you've been doing. So it, kind of interesting. A lot of this is, you know, as soon as you read this, I think you start to identify and notice things in our modern day outdoor industry. And that's the beauty of history, right? And tying these through lines back to the 1800s to present day. I guess with that, are there any other ideas or qualities you know, or impacts of the outdoor industry going back to the 1800s that you can tie a through line to that kind of impact our experience with gear and in the outdoors today that surprised you?
Sure. I was surprised by how late in this story outdoor clothing became popular style, because I grew up in an era where North Face puffy jackets or fleece as kind of an everyday attire was so common. I hadn't really understood the era of the early 20th century when that really wasn't the case, when people were worried, what if somebody sees me in my outdoor clothing? I better change before my neighbors know what I've been up to, right? That's such a difference from where we are now. And I think like understanding how outdoor clothing came to be so popular from the 70s on to the present kind of requires tracing, like, when was it kind of weird outlier clothing that only kind of these people out there were wearing to something that now is a part of mainstream culture? That's a really fun story as well.
What do you think the turning point is for when that shift happened?
I think by the 1970s, when the outdoor kind of activities were booming, when more people than ever were going to visit national parks, but also kind of looking at recreational activities outside closer to home, outdoor companies grew in tandem with that kind of interest. That by itself doesn't cause any style to become popular, right? That, you know, it's not necessarily how it works. But at the same time in the 1970s, Americans were eager to show off kind of their participation in fitness culture, their new attention to tone and active bodies. And so the fact that you could don clothing that signified your kind of relationship to activity in the outdoors was really appealing. First, to young people, especially college students, where outdoor clothing was a style in the late 60s and early 70s. And then it spread to kind of a much broader set of people, often to the lament of outdoor executives, right? They weren't always sure that this notion that, oh, outdoor clothing is cool now, it's really stylish, was a good thing for their brands and what their brands were meant to represent. But that's the direction that the kind of, you know, that the style trends went in the United States more broadly. And so now we're experiencing the after effects of that. People talk about GORPCore, right? The notion that kind of Gore-Tex or similar like technical products kind of make their way into everyday clothing that you would wear to class, to work, or kind of on a city sidewalk. And some poke fun at that, some embrace it because it's really great. But either way, it's really easy to see how from the 70s up until now, outdoor clothing as a popular style has been on the rise.
I'm curious what you think, and it's hard to generalize, but like the GORPCore movement, what do you think people are trying to say about themselves? You know, there's a trend for a little while on TikTok of like, you know, kids buying Arc'teryx jackets, really expensive Arc'teryx jackets, and standing in the shower, right? And turning the shower on and showing how waterproof their jacket was, mm-hmm. right? Like, but rarely going out and using these activities or doing these, you know, wearing that jacket for, you know, an extreme activity. What do you think people are trying to say about themselves as a part of this GORPCore movement? What are they trying to communicate?
Mm-hmm. Besides the kind of allegiance to like fitness culture and outdoor activities, which I think is a big part of it, I also, you know, want to note something we haven't talked about too much here is the really kind of like high expense of equipping yourself for the outdoors. Since the 19th century, acquiring these goods has not been cheap, which is why early on in the history of outdoor recreation, it was often kind of an elite activity. And these products were quite hard to come by because they were only accessible to the very wealthy. That's differently true in the 20th and 21st century, but certainly if you're wearing an Arc'teryx jacket in the shower to show off its technical features, you're also making a statement about your relative wealth, right? Your ability to afford these kinds of goods and to have, you know, a well-known brand emblazoned on your shirt, you know, as we often do in everyday life, is not just a signifier about outdoor expertise. It's about access to high-end consumer products.
Yeah. So it's ultimately you're communicating status mm-hmm. through clothing. Interesting.
Which is not unique to the outdoors, of course. Right. What's different here is that the outdoor industry has been central in kind of shaping where American fashions have gone and kind of bringing in sporting activities, much like, you know, Nike or Adidas have done as well in the 1980s onward, to the point where this is what everyday American clothes look like. Not high-end fashion designers, right? That's not what people wear on an everyday basis, but these companies have reshaped American style.
So I know that this book is there's it's very much an American focus. Just in the process of doing your research and writing, like, did you get a glimpse into the experience, you know, this, you know, similar experiences globally, you know, in Europe and in particular countries, like where outdoor activities are popular or there's a large outdoor industry? Like, did you get a sense of, you know, kind of what it's like in other countries or other parts of the world, and were they similar or different? I know that
Sure.
wasn't the focus of your research, but.
I mean, to answer that, I want to go kind of go back to what I talk about in my personal history in the preface, which is when I had this fellowship to go hiking kind of hut to hut around the world after college, what I experienced was how very different outdoor cultures and therefore the packing lists were for, you know, different regions around the world. And so when I went to Northern Europe or to South America and went hiking there, and I heard from locals about kind of what was wrong with the backpack that I brought, or how I had packed wrong, you know, fun things like that. And I also noted how different the styles were, like the boot styles, what pants people were wearing, even what materials they donned as they kind of went through the outdoors. And so, what I realized even at that early stage in this project was there wasn't one single right way to equip for the outdoors, and so many of kind of the expectations we have about here's what we ought to acquire, here's what it means to even experience the outdoors or the wilderness is particular to the cultures that we're a part of. And so in that sense, I don't have a good answer for here's what it's like in Switzerland, here's what it's like in Argentina, but I can tell you that kind of the local and national histories, the companies that sold there are really important parts of those kind of the developments of the industries in other areas. And I can tell you that by the kind of boom eras of the outdoor industry, especially from the 1970s onward, the overlap between different regions of the world that were producing and selling outdoor goods is quite strong. And so, though I focus, of course, on American companies, there kind of is the hovering presence in the background of the influences from other places. And the idea, even that kind of some of the best outdoor experts might come from the Alpine region of Europe, right? Not from the United States. And so, in that sense, I could get a sense for the other kind of currents around expertise, authenticity, even outdoor style that aren't particularly American, but surely are fascinating. And I really hope other people are writing about this so I can learn more.
Well, so that kind of leads me to, I guess, a follow-up question to that. What are the opportunities for additional scholarship in this space? Again, you're creating something entirely unique, and it's incredible what you've done. I imagine it's going to open opportunities or spark interest from others. Where would you like to see more scholarship in this space? What are the opportunities?
One of the things that I wasn't able to do much of, but I find really interesting, is the kind of cultural and political division of outdoor stores and consumers in the second half of the 20th century. So Bass Pro Shops, Cabela's don't play a really major role in this book, partly because of the archives I had access to. But of course, they are crucial arbiters of the American outdoor experience and the American outdoor identity. And so in that sense, I would love to learn more from others about kind of how that evolved and how it evolved so differently from the North Faces and Patagonias of the world as well. So that's one kind of direction of research I think is tracing the political affiliations, the conservation contributions of these different parts of the industry, and how they've really veered off in different kinds of directions, even as they share such a strong overlap when it comes to love of wild spaces and, you know, the production of really excellent products.
I think that's a fascinating area to look at because we even wrestle with that with the archive. It's we've you know we have to have a scope, and so we can't collect everything at the moment. You know, we've largely focused on camping, climbing, hiking, backpacking. You know, a lot of those activities that really boomed in the 70s. But the outdoor industry, there was so much happening in the hunt and fish space, you know, we collect materials from companies like L.L.Bean, Eddie Bauer, Abercrombie and Fitch that in the, you know, early half of the 20th century were primarily selling products for people doing those types of hunt and fish activities, right? So we do have a large hunt and fish collection, but we aren't currently collecting, you know, modern day hunt and fish brands because of that division. And I think there's opportunity for us to do more of that work, but I'd also be interested to see where that that split happened, where you have an outdoor retailer show, but then you have SHOT Show that's more, you know, hunt and fish, but then outdoor retailers more your, you know, camping, hiking, climbing. So yeah, definitely would love to see someone dive into that more. Other areas that have kind of sparked interest. I think there's a lot of opportunity in general, I imagine.
Yeah. One of the other ones has to do with the influence of kind of nonprofit organizations focused on kind of sustainability and conservation and wildlands that have been really prominent in the outdoor industry, certainly since the late 80s and especially in the 21st century. I don't think there's a really clear academic treatment of how that's shaped the business direction of many of these companies, but it has. And I'm curious to learn more about the relationship between the two sides of the work that people in the industry do, right? Their kind of environmental politics on the one hand, and then their business bottom line on the other. I think that's a fascinating and really useful avenue for further exploration as well.
Great. Well, any parting thoughts about the book? This was super helpful. Anything we missed? Any key themes that you want to plug?
Sure. Yeah, I think people, you know, might be hesitant to kind of explore a critical academic history of outdoor gear and clothing because they're worried like, oh no, what if the lesson of this book is like, I can't buy my beloved stuff anymore. That's certainly not the conclusion of this book. It's not a salacious tell-all, and it's not kind of a list of admonitions of here's the right way to do things and you've been doing it all wrong. That won't be the takeaway that anybody gets from it. So I can kind of assure people that they can maintain their love of gear while still kind of learning these deeper histories that allow them to think like in more depth about, oh, why do I love this stuff? And what does it say about who I am and kind of who I want to be?
That's great. Again, the book is Shopping All the Way to the Woods, How the Outdoor Industry Sold Nature to America, from Yale University Press. And you can buy it on their Yale University Press website, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, anywhere else?
Everywhere else you might get books.
Okay, perfect. And then your website, rachel-gross.com, for all your other work. I'll include all of this in the description of the episode. But Rachel, always love to have you on. It's always like, I always learn something. I love the work that you do, obviously. And I love that we get to continue to work together on projects. So I'm excited to actually get this book in my hands. It's ordered. You know, I, as soon as it was on pre-order, I had to get it. So I'm excited to dig into it deeper. So
all right, thanks
again for the time. Thanks for listening to the Highlander Podcast. For more conversations with outdoor leaders, subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, watch episodes on the Outdoor Product Design and Development YouTube channel, or on opdd.usu.edu/podcast. Follow along on Instagram at USU Outdoor Product and let us know how you're enjoying the show.